All right. Thank you very much, Amy. We're going through the book of Esther in the Bible. Today is part two. Last week we began this series looking at this book. There's a lot in this chapter, in chapter two. It's just a ton. If this was a movie, chapter two would be the longest because there's just so much action in it. And because we have so much to cover, I'm just going to quickly pray and we're going to jump right into the text of the Bible, okay? Father, we thank you that you have not left us in a world to be confused about different issues, but you've spoken through your word. You've told us stories. You've told us through poetry, and you've told us directly in so many different ways through all the different books of the Bible. You have revealed truth to us. You've revealed goodness to us. You've revealed beauty to us. We thank you that we are not lost in our own speculation and confusion, but that we have something solid to stand on. So as this is a very full chapter, God, help me to say the things that are on your heart for us as listeners to hear, to respond, to believe, to obey. And Lord, just put to the side those things that aren't helpful, I pray. Amen. Okay, well, Amy just read the whole chapter for us. And so we're going to go right in. I'm not going to repeat the whole thing, but it starts, you may have noticed, with these three words, sometime later. Sometime later. Those three words are the bridge from the last week's chapter where we talked about Queen Vashti being kind of banished from her throne by Xerxes for, you know, breaking Persian court protocol, for not coming when she was summoned. And then it says, sometime later. Well, how much time? Well, this sometime later was probably about 3 years. What happened in those 3 years? Well, Xerxes had gone off to war. He went off to finish what his father Darius had started but failed to do, and that was to conquer Greece. Now, this war, from a perspective of secular history, the Persian-Greek wars were extremely important. It's hard to overstate. I could put lots of adjectives like very, very, very important or super important or amazingly important. It's hard to put too many adjectives in front of just how important this war was from a perspective of European history. At this time, Greek culture was in its infancy in a way. The values of things like democracy were in their infancy stages. And this would be the culture that would grow up that would then impart a lot of its values to the Roman Empire. They imparted their language. Greek language was the main language of the Roman Empire. A lot of their values, their ideals, went to Rome. And then when Rome fell, a lot of those ideas then were transferred on to the places that would become the nations of Europe. If Persia had won, it would have imposed its culture on Greece. The experiments in the new ways of doing nations, city-states, the new ways the Greeks were beginning to organize themselves, it just never would have happened. What would Europe be like today if Persia had won this war? We don't know. It was a fantastic war, not just because only the effects, but the Greeks were so massively outnumbered. You're talking about, you know, it's hard to get an estimate because sometimes historians exaggerate, but you're looking at an army of some say exceeding 1 million coming from Persia to just a few thousand from Greece, outnumbered more than 10 to 1, far more than 10 to 1, and still the Greeks held their own. Fantastic, but from secular history, extremely important. And yet the Bible sums it up in these three words, sometime later. And then, you know, it gets right back to when Xerxes returns to Persia. That gives me a few things. One, you know, from my perspective of, you know, my subject, when I went off to uni originally, I was studying history and with hopes of becoming a history teacher someday. But that all changed, of course. But there's still something in me when I read that. I think, oh, God, don't you think you should give them just a little more attention to that? Like, that's a pretty significant war right there. There were some pretty significant battles and it changed the course of the world. And it's as if, you know, God's way of seeing history is just a little bit different than ours. The things that we think of as being really, really important from God's perspective might not be so important. The things that we think are small and insignificant, he may place fantastic importance upon. It'll be interesting when we get to heaven, not just to meet the people that who are there and to see Jesus, but also say, all right, you know, me at least, I'm really interested to say, all right, God, I want to see world history from heaven's perspective. Like, what did heaven want to focus on? What were the important things? And, you know, in that there might be seemingly small acts of love, humility, prayer, giving to the poor, like things that our historians would pass over, heaven's historians will not. But it says sometimes later, what happens? Well, Xerxes comes back. He was already a wild man before, as we looked last week. He was definitely an example of what today goes by the title, toxic masculinity. And arguably, and very arguably and debatably, his wife was a bit of an example of toxic femininity. But he comes back. He was already a mess. But now he comes back depressed and a mess. And if a man is already a mess and he comes back and he's depressed and a mess, it just, everything gets amplified. Historians, the Greek historians write that when he came back, he was so messed up, he gave himself to drunkenness, he gave himself to being in his harem quite a lot. That wasn't enough. It says this word, he remembered Vashti. That word remembered in, you know, the Old Testament, that phrase, he remembered her. It's more than just the English, oh, I forgot where my keys were and I remembered it. But it's like to be something very caringly brought before your attention. Like, you know, it says in Genesis, the Lord remembered Noah. His focus and his attention, the focus of activity went upon him. Well, he remembered Vashti. He remembered, you know, even though it seems like they didn't have a great marriage, at least she was a fitting companion. You know, in a way, they were two peas in a pod. They were, you know, in my opinion, the opinion of many others, they were equally dysfunctional. And in a way, he longed for her. And history records that he started sleeping with the wives of his aristocrats and his nobles, which of course they didn't appreciate very much. So some of them get an idea and they go talk to one of his attendants. And this attendant carries this idea from the nobles to the king. It says, King, your highness, if I may be so bold, may I make a suggestion? Yes, go ahead and speak. Well, you know, king, that you know, I can tell, if you don't mind me saying so, Your Majesty, that you probably miss your queen.
Maybe.
Well, King, maybe we could replace the queen. And here's how we could do it. We could go through your empire of 50 million people and find the absolute most gorgeous girls in the entire empire. And we could have a contest. We'll call it The Bachelor or something. The ratings will be great on television. And you know, you have a date with a different one of them, you sleep with them each night, and then, you know, out of all of them, you pick the winner and she can be the new queen. And it says in the Bible that he liked this idea. Yeah, I bet he did. And so the word goes out and they send out the soldiers and they collect the most beautiful girls. History varies in the record of how many, between 1 to 400. And between 1 to 400 out of a population of 50 million, you know, these were the most beautiful girls anywhere in the Persian Empire. And they were collected and taken back to the palace. It says then, it shifts. If this is a movie, all of a sudden the scene would shift. And all of a sudden, it starts focusing on another man, not Xerxes, but a man very different than Xerxes, a guy named Mordecai. Mordecai had a good job. He was kind of a higher level administrator within the Persian government. He's probably a younger man, maybe in his 20s or so. We don't know exactly. And it says that this guy, he was Jewish, first of all. And it says that he was Jewish, living in Susa. Well, how did that happen? Well, the Jews had rebelled against God. God had taken them as slaves out of Egypt, brought them to the Promised Land, but they kept worshiping other gods. And God sent them prophets to warn them, don't do this. If you turn and rebel against the God who gave you this land, you'll lose this land. But they didn't want to hear that. They didn't want to obey the God who had given them that land. And so, well, what happened? Well, the Babylonians came, destroyed the Jewish army, destroyed the city, but instead of killing everyone, they sort of kidnapped everyone and took them back to Babylon. Well, after about 70 years or so, Cyrus, who was the founder of the Persian Empire, he comes and he defeats much of the Babylonian Empire, takes Babylon, and he decides to to free the Jews. He's like, you guys don't have to be here anymore. You guys can go home. And so a lot of them had started going home. That was about 70 years earlier. So there was Cyrus, then there were Cyrus's two sons. That didn't end well. Then Darius, who's a very distant relative of Cyrus, he kind of usurps the throne from his sons, which are a bit of a mess. And then Xerxes takes over from Darius. So 70 years had gone by since Cyrus had done this. A lot of Jews had now left what is now the Persian Empire to go back to Israel, but some had stayed. And there's a big Jewish population there in Susa, one of the capitals of the Persian Empire. And Mordecai is one of those who has not left yet. And it says that he has a cousin. He has this female cousin, this girl named Hadassah, and her parents died. Now, it sounds like there's some backstory to this. I'd love to know what the backstory is. How did they die? It sounds like she's an only child. Did her mother die in childbirth and then her father die a few years later? Why did her cousin adopt her? Like, that's unusual. That would have been very unusual for, you know, why not a closer relative? Why not a grandparent? Why not an aunt? Why not an uncle? Why not? I don't know. It doesn't give us the backstory. I'm assuming that many other relatives have gone to Israel already, and that Mordecai adopted her for one of two reasons. One, he may have been legitimately the closest relative. She wasn't of marrying. Often cousins would marry cousins back then, but she was still a little girl. She was too young to be married. She didn't need a husband. She needed parents. She needed guardians. Secondly, he had a very good job. So whether he was the closest relative or the relative with the most financial means, probably some combination of there. His job would have been well enough for him to have a couple of servants to probably help him out raise Hadassah. But he adopts her. He takes his little cousin into his house, begins to be a guardian to her. She is his ward, so to speak, an adopted daughter, as much as you can be an adopted father to someone who's naturally your cousin. And this is a very different sort of, these are our other characters. We've met the king. We met the queen last week. We're not going to hear much more from her. But Mordecai and Hadassah, they're Jewish. And that in the Persian Empire, they would have been more, in today's language, we would say they're more socially conservative. They were monotheist. They had their own rules or guidelines, what they ate, what they didn't eat, where they went, how they spoke. And yet they were within the Persian system. And it says that this girl was, the young woman had a beautiful figure and was extremely good looking. And all the single guys say, amen. That is what I'm praying for right there. She was a Jewish girl. That was just a knockout, apparently. She was beautiful. And this word beauty is used a lot in these verses. It says, that the let there be look for beautiful young women, and let them have beauty treatments, and Esther is beautiful, and let them be dressed beautifully. And the word beauty is used quite a lot in just a few verses. And frankly, if we don't take this moment to talk about what the Bible says about beauty, I don't know any other chapter that's kind of a better springboard for it. And do you ever think about this? Like, do you understand what I mean? Do you ever think about what is beauty? If someone came up to you on the street and said, give me a definition of beautiful. What does it mean to be beautiful? Some alien came from outer space or whatever. Someone said, what does it mean to be beautiful? How would you define that for them? Something that looks nice. Oh, really? Is there no such thing as a beautiful piece of music? Oh, okay. Well, something that looks nice and sounds nice. Or what if I read beautiful poetry or beautiful literature? And say, okay, it's actually really hard to define beautiful other than saying the quality of having beauty, which only removes the question one more. Like, well, what is that then? it is really hard to give something by the very essence of beauty. It's kind of hard to pin down to a dictionary definition. It's a bit like goodness, or truth. It transcends creation. It's everywhere, and yet it's hard to kind of pin it down. The Bible talks a lot about beauty. It refers to it. It's just there from the beginning to end. If you look Genesis chapter 1, for example, Genesis 1, God makes creation, and he's creating all these things, and he says, it is good. He makes something, and then he looks at it and says, wow, that's good. And that word, tob, there in Hebrew, tob, it means goodness, but it means goodness more in the old-fashioned sense of the word. Like in English, we have an old-fashioned word. If you ever read Shakespeare, any of the old English literature, they have this word goodly. He was a goodly man or a goodly woman. Yeah, that's it's slightly different. Good today often refers to behavior, very like he's a good boy or a good girl. Where if they said goodly, it could refer to looks, you know, to appearance as well as behavior. And this is what that word means when it says God says it was good. That same word is also translated as beautiful in other parts of the Hebrew scriptures. And so God says, it is good, not just on the inside, but on the outside. Like, it's beautiful, it's great, it's, you know. And so beauty is pronounced right at the very beginning of the Bible. And then he creates man and woman and says, you know, God created mankind in his image, in the image of God. He created them male and female, he created them. He says, it is very, tob, it is very good, it is very beautiful. And so beauty's right at the beginning. A beautiful God made a beautiful creation and put a very beautiful man and woman right in the garden. So beauty is there from the beginning. It's hard to define, and yet the Bible celebrates it as coming from God. God is the author of beauty. Now, it's important to pin that down because we have a very unhealthy relationship with beauty in our world. Sin has entered the world, and everything that was once good has been tainted. That's what, you know, sometimes theologians mean by total depravity. I don't know if you've ever heard that term. If you've been in church for a while, maybe you've heard this term, total depravity. At first, it sounds kind of dark and very pessimistic, but all it means is that sin has tainted everything to at least some degree. It doesn't mean that there's no goodness in the world. Oh, heaven forbid, that's not what total depravity means. But it does mean that everything that was once totally good has been tainted. It's like you have all these, you know, bottles of water, and a little drop of ink has been dropped in each. Some, a lot, like some things are really screwed up, some things less so. It doesn't mean everything's as bad as it could be, but it means everything has been tainted. And beauty is one of those things, you know. We have eating disorders, we have pornography, we have manipulative advertising, comparison, division, pride, jealousies, all sorts of things can come not because beauty is bad, but because our hearts are twisted and we don't relate to it in a healthy way. Beauty. What should we say about that? We create things that are beautiful. You know, God made us beautiful, and because we're made in his image, we then go and we create things. If you're a doctor and you're maybe stitching up somebody's scar, you know, you don't want them to look like Frankenstein when you're done. You want it to be very subtle and almost hidden. You want the person, when the scar heals, you want it to look nice. If you're a painter, you want the room that you paint it to look nice. You know, if you're a baker, you're making someone a birthday cake, you don't want it to just taste good. You want it to look nice. If you're decorating the church or cleaning the church, you know, it's like if your job is a cleaner, well, you want the place you clean to look nice. If I'm writing something as someone who likes to write, I just don't want to convey facts. I want what I write to sound nice, so beautiful in the broadest possible sense of the term. We make beauty. God made us beautiful. We create beautiful. And we create things that are beautiful. But why is it there? I already said that God created it and put it in creation. Well, because he is beautiful. And when we see beauty in creation, whether it's in a person or a piece of music or food or a sunset or whatever, we should give thanks for it and look to God and say, God, wow, that's so beautiful. Thank you for making that. You're a beautiful God and you make beautiful things. But what we tend to do because of sin is we make idols of it. We try to possess it. We try to own it. We try to make it ours, you know, and kind of that. In the J.R.R. Tolkien's book, there's that character of Smeagol who becomes Gollum when he's just fascinated by the beauty of the ring, and it must be mine, my precious, you know, and he's just, he's obsessed with this beautiful little golden ring, and it affects him, it becomes his idol, it becomes his god, and he becomes disfigured. But we do that, we do the same. We try to possess and own beauty instead of giving thanks for it. And this is what Xerxes is doing. He's taking all these beautiful young women to own them. Like, they're not signing up for this. I read a couple of commentaries where it almost suggested that, well, you know, maybe Hadassah just signed up and went and volunteered. Like, no. No. Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, it's true that I'm sure every girl would have loved to be queen. Like, who doesn't want to be the empress? Like, duh. But it's the fact that so many people are competing. What happens if you lose? You don't go back home to mommy and daddy. If you lose, you get stuck in the harem for the rest of your life. And you never get to see your family. Like, you're stuck in there. You're trapped. It's a golden cage, but it's still a cage. Oh, it's probably not the worst fate possible. It's like, well, your needs are taken care of. You have food and shelter. And even back in those days, that was something. You can't take that for granted. But there was no freedom. You never had the companionship of a husband or to raise kids in a normal way. I mean, if you got pregnant, the kids would be raised in the harem and probably work in the court as dishwashers or something. And those were the chances. Like, hundreds of girls are signing up for this. And unless you were extremely overconfident and you were sure you could win this, you weren't too happy about being in this contest. You were taken. Yeah, that's the word. It says she was taken. So the girls were taken there. Mordecai adopts a girl and raises her to be a godly woman. Xerxes takes a girl, not to build her up into strong, wise womanhood, but he takes her in order to consume her. Like, those are two men relating to women in two very different ways. Both from a position of strength, but one from a position of strength to build up, the other of a position of strength to consume and build himself up. There's a hunger in us for beauty. You know, we long to go to a concert to hear that beautiful music. We long to go to an art gallery to see a beautiful painting. We want to go to the cinema and see a movie just filled with a beautiful story that moves us. And that's right, we were created for beauty. But all those things point to a higher source. You know, there will be a day when we enter into heaven and we see the face of Christ. And that will be the beauty that transforms us. That will be the beauty that so moves us. Like, you know, you see that movie or hear a story and you're like, wow, that's moving. It touches something deep in you. One day we will see something so beautiful that it just won't touch us or move us, but it will ultimately transform us to make us be the man or the woman that we were created by God to be. This isn't just talking about this passage. It's just not talking about beauty in general, though, is it? It's talking about beauty, a certain type of beauty, particularly feminine beauty. Like, there's lots of things in beauty and creation, you know, sunsets, food, fruit, animals. You know, you can see beauty out there. But it's feminine beauty, which is a particular type of beauty. I mean, we humans relate to beauty in a way very different from animals, I think. I don't think animals are necessarily unaware of beauty, or at least not all animals, but not like us. Nothing close. I mean, the way humans relate to beauty is just, it's nothing like the animal kingdom. Oh, sure, a bird can be attracted to a red berry, swoop down to eat it because it's hungry. A female koala can hear the mating call of a male koala and think it's beautiful, be moved by it, and then go and make babies with that male koala. But humans are the ones who like beauty for its own sake. Like, we can look at something beautiful in nature or in painting and appreciate the beauty, and it has nothing to do with our digestive system or reproductive system or passing on our DNA. Like, we appreciate beauty for its own sake. We listen to the music of Bach from hundreds of years ago and we reflect on it and think about life, and like, there's just nothing like that in the animal kingdom. And there are evolutionary, you know, people try to use evolutionary explanations to talk about how we have this appreciation for beauty. I just don't find them very satisfying. I think Genesis 1 provides a more satisfying answer. A beautiful God made us beautiful and with the capacity to think about and make beautiful things for the sake of beauty, you know. And find one another beautiful. Like, we can find people beautiful without necessarily wanting to, you know, make babies with them. You can just say, well, that's a beautiful person. That person has beautiful eyes. You can observe beauty. And the Bible talks a fair bit about feminine beauty. I mean, there's a couple times guys are mentioned as being good looking. Joseph, for one, in the book of Genesis. David is mentioned that when he was a boy, he was a good looking boy. And Daniel and his friends, after they fasted, it says they were looking good after the fast. Now, how they looked before, we don't know. But comparatively, they were looking all right after they fasted, which was kind of a miracle. But it talks about feminine beauty. A lot of emphasis is put on, you know, describing women as being beautiful, and Esther here being beautiful both in body and in face. She was just very nice to look at. And God, the thing is, God created it that way. God created feminine beauty. Feminine beauty is nothing to be ashamed of. It's nothing to look down on. It's nothing to, because of sin, we can connect shame with sexuality, with feminine beauty sometimes, and think like those things are bad or dirty, and it's not. These things came from God. Feminine beauty. Ladies, if you like what you see when you look in the mirror and you get complimented either by your husband or somebody else and told you're beautiful, great. Look up to God and say, thank you very much. Thank you for creating me that way. Like, that's great. If you've done well in the gene pool, like, super, good on you. As a man, I think all women are beautiful because, well, generally speaking, all women are more beautiful than I am, at least. I know within womankind, there's kind of a comparison, and some are more beautiful than others, but hey, they're all more beautiful than me. So, ladies, you're all lovely. You're welcome. But because of sin, it leads to different problems. You know, 1 Timothy chapter 2, it says, Paul writes to the women, he says, women, adorn yourselves modestly. Okay, two things there. One, Paul is affirming feminine beauty is a good thing. He says, adorn yourselves. Like, it's okay to celebrate your femininity. It's okay to put on that nice blouse, that nice dress, that new bit of makeup, those earrings, like whatever. Adorn yourselves. God created you to be feminine. Celebrate it. But do it modestly. Well, and what was Paul referring to? You know, Paul was most likely referring to the class structures. He kind of goes on to talk about gold and hair. And back then, not everyone could afford gold. Not everyone could afford jewelry. Rome was a very strict class system, and people were in different classes. And those classes were never supposed to mix. And the churches were looked down for mixing classes together in one place. But you'd have the rich worshiping next to the poor. And for the sake of unity, it's like, okay, all you women in the upper classes who can afford jewelry and gold, when you come to church, please don't like get all decked out, don't weave the gold in your hair and braids and, do those things, which would cause the women from the lower classes who can't afford that to, you know, it caused division. It would emphasize your differences. So please, adorn yourselves. Just do it modestly, you know, do it without all the bling. In any way that would cause division. Well, that's kind of one way that we relate to beauty in unhealthy ways. That's not the only way. Pride, that's a big one, right? Pride in externals. Wow, I'm good looking on the outside, so I must be okay with on the inside. And I think sometimes we do that. We spend a lot of time in front of the mirror, spend a lot of time maybe trying to get fit, go to the gym. I mean, men can do this too, as well as women. We want to get fit, and why? Well, there's something deeply wrong with us on the inside. And because we can't just reach in and change our own heart, we try to change the outside on our body. And if we have some degree of success, maybe you've got a gym membership and maybe you've been using it and maybe you're beginning to like what you see in the mirror. Well, good for you. That's you. Well done. But don't think that necessarily changes your heart. In fact, if you begin to trust that you're more valuable, more important, a better person just because you look better on the outside, then that's just pride. That'll make matters worse. You'll just become more spiritually blind. There's something ugly with us on the inside. Sometimes we can be cruel, we can be mean, we can be nasty. There can be some real inner ugliness there. But hey, when I look in the mirror, I like what I see, so everything's fine. No. Don't let that pride slip in. Not only pride, it leads to divisiveness, pride, deception. Deception. I mean, how often, has a young man fallen for a young woman because, she looks great. And, maybe he rushes and marries her. But she turns out to be this really mean and nasty and horrible person. It's like, well, we have that expression, don't judge a book by its cover. And we say that all the time, don't judge a book by its cover. And yet, frankly, we all do that far more than we think. in advertising. And I have a friend in behavioral economics, and it's his job, you know, he jokes about it, it's his job basically to help companies sell products. And the way they use beauty and images and different things that catch the eye to sell a product and be able to charge more for it because there's some image attached. You know, we are just so easily misled by image and by beauty. Beauty's all over this place. She gets taken. She gets taken because she's beautiful. She gets taken because Xerxes has an unhealthy relationship with beauty, and he's a lust monkey. Let's just say it. Xerxes is a lust monkey, and he wants to own all these beautiful women. And she gets taken there. Now, she is all of a sudden locked up. She's locked up in a nice place, the king's harem. You know, this place has been excavated, and we know where this building was, and it was a lovely place. But she was locked in there. Some of you guys might feel that way now. Maybe you're in your home. Maybe your home is a nice place, but because of the coronavirus, because of this lockdown we're all in, you're trapped in there. You know, you can't go anywhere. Well, you might say that Hadassah, later, you know, her name's going to be called Esther later. Esther is, she has her own lockdown. She can't go anywhere, but hers is worse than ours. I mean, imagine right now if the police were at your house, kind of standing by the door, just to make sure you don't go outside. Here in England at the moment, at least we're allowed one walk a day. It's like, thanks. You know, you can go out and take a walk, just stay so many meters away from people. Hadassah had a bit of that. She couldn't go outside at all. Maybe they had a courtyard for the women, where the women could go outside, get some vitamin D. I guess they were smart enough to know some sunlight was important. But they couldn't go out and see people. They couldn't socialize. The only men they'd ever see would be eunuchs. And I'm not sure they were considered men in the Persian mentality. You know, that's why they were there, to make sure no men got near the women. So she was under her own lockdown. Mordecai, too, he was facing a different set of challenges. You know, it records that every day when he would leave work, because he worked in the citadel, he worked in the heart of the government, he would intentionally walk by the harem on his way from work to home to see if he could pick up any news. Now, in that, he was probably luckier than most parents. I mean, most parents never even got to go near the citadel. But because of his job, you know, he at least got to go near the building, and he would hear rumors and ask the eunuchs or the servants, well, what's the latest word? Because, you know, people gossip, servants gossip, the eunuchs would gossip. And sometimes he would pick up news about this girl called Esther. So I feel for Mordecai. Like, I mean, some of you are in a Mordecai situation right now, aren't you? You have a parent or a grandparent or a brother, a sister, or a spouse, or a child who is sick. Maybe they have the coronavirus, maybe it's something else, but you want to be there for them, you want to help them, and you can't be. You can't see them. You can't see the person you love. Mordecai, I mean, this was his little cousin, his adopted daughter, and she was just taken from him. He's eager for news. He wants to be there to help her, but he can't. And if that's you, if you're in this position, you have someone in the hospital or someone in their house, and you just can't go see them because you want to help them, know that just because you can't be with them doesn't mean God's not with them. God can be with them. And God, even though Mordecai can't be with Hadassah, God is with her. And you see that in this chapter, like, she flourishes here. Let this be a challenge to many of us who are in a lockdown right now. Hadassah, Esther, she was in a lockdown, and she's flourishing. She is doing well. God is with her. And she's experiencing a huge cultural change. Like, she's from a Jewish, socially conservative Jewish family. All of a sudden, in this wild, sexually debauched Persian world, the paganism, and it was just a completely different world. And this would have been a great opportunity for self-pity. This would have been a great opportunity for the, woe is me, my life is the hardest, no, I have the worst life ever. I mean, she is a teenage girl after all. She is a teenage girl. She's probably about 15 or so at this time. And, you know, she could have done with many other 15-year-old girls. And many adults, might I add, do when things get difficult. Complain, moan, this is unfair. It was all those things. Of course it was unfair. Life is unfair, you know. And yet, she doesn't put on any sort of victim mentality. She flourishes. Like, she befriends the main eunuch. Many other girls might have been loathing life. They were facing a future in the harem. This was not on their life plans. This was a part of their life goals, you know. They were facing a future in the harem. And yet she goes in, she's going to make the best of her situation. Some of you in the lockdown right now, how can you make the best of this? This might last another several weeks, another month or so. I have no idea at this point. I pray to God we're done with this as soon as possible because I'm getting annoyed at the whole thing. And yet, hey, this is what we're asked to do, so this is what we'll do. And let's not spend it complaining. Let's flourish under it. Some of you have said, I don't have enough time to read, or I don't have enough time to pray, or I don't have enough time to write letters, or you have some time now. Now, I know if you're a doctor or nurse, maybe you're working more than ever before. A few people are. But for some of you, you're stuck at home. Do those things. Flourish during this time. Esther is flourishing. She makes friends with this pagan eunuch, which that was outside of the box for her. Like that's, she wasn't, as a Jewish girl being raised in Mordecai's house, she wasn't hanging around pagan eunuchs a lot. Yet she befriends a man, very different from her. He's a safe male friend because, you know, he was a eunuch. Parents, children, you can ask your parents about that. So she does well, and the eunuch is so taken by her. Like, he's never met a girl like this before. She is, I don't know how she does, but she befriends. She probably making him feel honored, respected. I don't know. But she is treating him in a way that none of the other girls are treating him. A deference or respect. I don't know exactly how she did it, but he was so moved by her friendship that he gives her special favor, a special diet, special beauty treatments that the other girls didn't necessarily have access to. And wouldn't it be great if, you know, she wrote a book today, Esther's Beauty Secrets, the beauty diet of Esther, whatever. She'd make millions, you know. What was that diet? We don't know. She had a particular diet. The Bible says a very special diet to help enhance her natural beauty. We don't know what it is. You're like, oh. Can we go back and, you know, obviously the author of the book of Esther must have been a man because, you know, a woman would have put in those sorts of details, I'm sure. But she had a special diet. She had all these special things from Hege. He helps her out and he begins to teach her things that Mordecai, I'm sure he was a great mentor. I'm sure he was a great father figure. I'm sure Mordecai taught her a lot. And in fact, it says twice in this chapter that she still followed the instructions of Mordecai. Like, she still hid her Jewish identity. She's using the name Esther, which is a Persian name and not the Hebrew name Hadassah. So she's using her Persian name out there. And she was following what Mordecai had instructed her. He had really mentored her very well in her early life. She had held on to those principles, and yet she was still learning this pagan learning, you know, and trying to blend the two. And sometimes as churches, as Christians, we have this challenge where we're citizens of heaven, but we live in the institutions of this world. You know, when we buy things, when we go to the store and buy things, we know a part of that money is probably going to institutions or causes that we don't fully agree with. And so sometimes we try to buy fair trade this or that, but we can't always. When we pay our taxes, it goes to the government, and sometimes that money is used in ways that we know isn't fully in line with our convictions as Christians. And it's interesting that the author of Esther, this book of Esther, here in chapter 2, he passes no moral judgments on Esther. He doesn't affirm, like, yeah, Esther did the right thing here. It was good for her to hide her Jewish identity. It was good for her to try to win. This was basically a sex contest. I mean, there's probably more to it than just that, but sex was pretty central to this whole thing. You know, they didn't spend a full year getting her body ready just so she could impress the king with her personality. That probably fit into, but that wasn't as central, perhaps. And so she's taking advice, holding on to the advice from Mordecai, but still learning from Hege. Sometimes as churches, you know, we have to navigate this, like, what? Because churches have to constantly change. With each new generation, as the years pass, we have to change our music and our decoration and how our buildings look and how we do church. Do we do church online? Is doing church online like this just as good as doing church in person? Like, these are difficult questions. They're not always so easy to answer. Most churches at this time feel we can do church online. There's a few out there who feel it's central to their identity to meet in person. Okay, well, we might disagree with them, but, you know, that's their conviction. It's hard. These things are hard. These issues are hard. What do I learn that's Persian, and how can I adapt myself to my environment that doesn't compromise my identity as a Hebrew or as one of the people of God? And there's no moral judgment. It's a very tough call. She obviously participates in this contest. I mean, she could have just sat down, folded her arms and said, right, I am not going to participate in this thing because this is a broken, evil system that exploits women or whatever. And she could have done that. She probably would have been executed and killed, impaled on a stake for doing that. Or she just, you know, she would have been thrown to Xerxes as king. She wouldn't have been for a very interesting date, call it that. And she would have been sent to the harem, never to be called upon again to live a lonely life. But she's in this situation. It's not a good situation, but she's like, hey, if I'm going to be in this situation, I'm going to try to win. And she does. She does. I mean, she's got to compete. She wasn't trying to lose. It's like, this isn't a contest that's very hard to lose. Like, if you want to lose a sex contest, it's pretty easy to lose. Like, you just don't have to try much. But she wins. She wins. With the author passes no moral judgment on her, and she goes in and she knocks the king's socks off. Like, wow, that's pretty impressive. Remember, this is a 15-year-old virgin, socially conservative Jewish girl going to a 40-year-old playboy who's very well experienced with his harem. Like, that would have been intimidating. I'm sure that was very intimidating for her. Yeah, God was with her. God was with her. I mean, how that works, I don't know. But you see the hand of God with her, connecting her with Hege, getting the information she needs, and she becomes queen. And this is key to the whole story of the salvation of God's people. Now, there's a little more to it than this. At the end of the chapter, there's this bit about Mordecai exposing the whole plot, the assassination plot. Well, I'm just going to go ahead and save that till next week. It's a bit of a shorter chapter. We've talked a lot about beauty here, and rightfully so. As I said, the Bible talks a lot about beauty, but it probably climaxes in the Gospels at the cross. Like, you see that cross behind me over my shoulder there. Yeah, that's the one. Is that a beautiful symbol or an ugly symbol? Well, just on the wall there, it's just a piece of wood. You might say it as a simple, minimalist loveliness about it, but what it stands for, like to see a real cross, a real crucifixion, like that was horrendous, that was ugly, to see a man slowly dying or being executed on the cross, all torn up and bloody, and it was horrific. You'd want to turn your eyes away. It would be difficult to see. You'd have to, you know, you wouldn't want to see that. That's how ugly it was, and yet it's become the most beautiful symbol in the world that there's been more paintings of, more songs written about, more books written about than any other symbol, than any other thing in the history of the world. Jesus Christ had a beauty that far surpassed anything Queen Esther in all her regal attire winning that contest would have had. Jesus had a beauty that, you know, it says in the Bible that angels, you know, have to cover their eyes, screaming, holy, holy. Can't even, such is the beauty of God, even the perfect angels can't even look on him. You know, it says Moses, he said, show me your glory. And God says, I can't show you my face because you wouldn't be able to live if you did, if you saw my face. Jesus had a beauty that surpasses everything and anyone in the whole universe. And what did he do with all that beauty? What did he do with all that glory? He gave it all away. He became wrapped up as just a simple, relatively unattractive Middle Eastern bloke. And he died the ugliest death imaginable. And why did he do that? Why did he give that all up? Well, so he could give us the only type of beauty that really matters. The beauty of a clean conscience, the beauty of a pure heart, the beauty of a forgiven spirit. And he gives that to us. He gives us his beauty. And that ugliness that's on the cross, that's our ugliness. We hand that over to him. And that's what transforms us. We often say, don't judge a book by its cover. But we always do. But if you know this sort of God, if you know this sort of God that doesn't cling on to beauty and hold on to his own beauty, but freely gives it all away and embraces ugliness in order to love us, man, that really sets us free from the whole beauty myth that's out there in our culture, the beauty myth we can never really seem to get free from. Well, Jesus beats that beauty myth and gives us power to live free from the way, the unhealthy ways, that wrong notions of beauty have over our life. Okay. I think that's us. Thank you very much for joining us this Sunday. Have a great week, and we will see you back here next Sunday for Esther Part 3.